In the Voice of Russia World Service, we present the program Red Line.
Welcome to the Voice of Russia and its weekend program, The Red Line. Every weekend, we, Sergei Strokin, Mira Salganik, and Yekaterina Kudashkina, invite you to discuss the most significant events of the week. We are joined by Russian and international experts, politicians, scientists, and artists, sharing or opposing our views on the vast and increasingly interdependent world shared by all of us.
We want our program to be personal, provocative, and fair.
So this week, we will start with the Belarus financial woes, which risk to develop into a full-scale economic and social crisis triggered off by the growing distrust in the Lukashenko government handling of the national economy. We will then take a look at Libya, analyzing whether Russia's much-discussed engagement in the conflict resolution effort could help in negotiating the long-awaited settlement in the war-torn country. And finally, we will talk about Serbian General Ratko Mladic, head of the Serbian armed forces during the Balkan War, brought to the United Nations War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague.
So, in each story we have a personal drama, a personal tragedy behind it, be it Lukashenko or Gaddafi or Mladic?
Well, it's their personal tragedies, no doubt, but that means tragedies for millions also. And all the thing is going to show that the interdependent world we are talking about is full of barricades, sometimes visible, sometimes invisible, but there are many of them.
Yeah, I think the barricades, this is the key words, and really too many of them.
Too many of
them. Okay, and now I invite you to discuss it. Beyond the headlines, this is our first heading in which we will examine the events in Belarus. The news coming these days from Belarus actually seems to be turning this ex-Soviet republic, well, relatively rarely mentioned by the world media, into another big international story. The reports from Minsk, some of them quite dramatic, indicate that Belarus, a country with a population of some 10 million, squeezed between Russia and Poland, has probably entered the most difficult period since it proclaimed independence. Some say there is high risk of it turning into another sensitive spot in the post-communist Eastern Europe.
Well, Katya, I think that there's a risk, a certain temptation of over-dramatizing the Belarus issue. We media men used to...
We
are rushing for headlines. So sometimes we...
Tend to exaggerate?
Yeah, this is a problem. Do you think that the situation is that serious in Belarus?
Well, for one thing, if you ask me, as a media person, I'd say that there is very little information, well-balanced information, coming from Belarus.
But you have given a lot of this background, flurry of reports, you know?
Oh, yes. But that is only one problem. And the other problem, to me, world media has becoming gradually less and less unbiased. I do hope, Sergei, that you are right, and that those deliberations tend to over-dramatize the story. But we could look at what Western media is saying, and I quote, Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko, labeled at the West as the last dictator of Europe, has ordered to shut down a number of foreign media outlets with a specific reference to Russian media as the main source of stirring up hysteria, which actually amounts to some kind of media wars again.
Well, the media wars about Belarus has never stopped last summer, or rather beginning of autumn. You remember the information war about Lukashenko personally on Russian TV. So then there was a lull. Now it's again there. But what Kremlin did, Lukashenko's job was immediately rebuffed by the Kremlin, while who, through a source, highly placed, I'm told, has told the Interfax agency that if implemented, it was not very elegant, but still a good job, then Russia will be made inevitably to reconsider the loan which is now negotiating with Belarus.
Mira, but this reaction could have been expected, I think.
Well,
it's
quite logical. Yes, it was logical. I mean, if you started, accusing the Russian media of stirring up hysteria or paranoia or something, then the other side reacts. Well, I guess that the reaction of the Kremlin was, should I say it is a cumulative reaction? Because when they tell you that your media men are stirring up hysteria, and you say no loan, if that is so. Well, I think this is overreacting. But there was, as we right now said, this is not the first instance. Things were accumulating. I mean, between Russia and Belarus, don't you think so?
Well, just let me follow with the loan job and with the newspaper quotations. So, days before the scandal over Russian and other foreign media broke out, Russia's Deputy Prime Minister Alexei Kudrin said that Belarus could get the total of $3 billion in loans from an economic alliance of several ex-Soviet nations, which obviously Russia is the largest donor. Over the next 3 years, including the first 800 million that could be delivered next month. Look, what we are seeing now, to me, actually looks like media war with some use of financial instruments.
That's right. And that reminds me, you know, of a typical autocratic approach to domestic problems. Who is responsible for the misery? Media. Who is responsible for inflation?
Oh, yes.
Media,
well,
all the journalists are
blamed.
Responsible.
Yes, I know.
Why don't they keep mum? Yeah. Then there would be no media, inflation,
but,
no things.
But as a follow-up to what you say, Katya, ironically, that ban on Russian media came shortly after Belarus National Bank sharply devalued the national currency against the dollar. So that was quite a dramatic move for Belarus. And that really came as a shockwave for the country, and people rushed just to devastate store shelves out of basic goods.
Yes, I remember,
you know,
those reports, and they were quite amazing. It was something quite unusual for Belarus.
Well, it was unusual for Belarus and remarkable for us.
Yes, yeah, of course, so, I still remember the 1998.
Yes, so according to reports of Russian media, which is lambasted by Lukashenko, not only Russian media, but foreign media as well, poor folk were taking everything from salt and sugar to locally made household appliances and electronics, and they also queued up at currency exchange offices in a desperate mood just to protect their savings.
In fact, that is another proof that people start to distrust the way Mr. Lukashenko is handling the situation.
Mira, doesn't it remind you of a Soviet time?
Well, yes, of course it does. Remember, that was the time when Moscow was sort of wrapped up in queues, and Soviet Union at that time was called the Q-land. So we remember it all.
Well, it rather reminds me of the 1998 default, like I already said, if you remember.
Again, yeah.
But now, this time, Mr. Lukashenko seems to be holding some key figures of Belarus cabinet responsible for what's going on. To be more precise, it is Prime Minister Mikhail Mesnikovich and the head of the National Bank, Pyotr Prokopovich. And President Lukashenko warned that cabinet members' heads would roll first if the situation in the country's exchange and consumer markets is not stabilized within days. From today, any rise in prices should be suppressed with all severity, he said.
Lukashenko ordered prices to behave well. So he made such an order as if rebellious prices could be dealt with as a remaining pocket of resistance of already suppressed Belarus opposition.
Well, the circle of the interested has been growing. So now look, President Barack Obama, too, felt he needed to react. So he gave the Belarus story a global dimension. While in Warsaw, the final stop in his week-long European tour, he said, and I quote, President Lukashenko has shown a total disregard for democratic values, the rule of law, and the human rights of his own people.
You know, Katya, I think that by saying so, Obama indicated that President Lukashenko would have no more chance to capitalize on differences between Russia and the West.
Well, yeah.
And that was the practice he commonly exploited in recent years, sometimes quite successfully. He was blackmailing Moscow by suggestion that unless Belarus is not properly paid from the Russian pocket, from the Russian budget, it would turn westwards.
But that's a faulty. That's one of the key issues to me. Because in that case, his assumption could be wrong. Because Belarus has been working with the IMF, which is the International Monetary Fund, for just in case, for quite some time already, and has not become the West's darling as yet, as we all know. It's not that easy
so
to become the West's darling.
So this practice doesn't work now, you see?
Yes, of course. And moreover, the world media, even the leading papers, spare no effort to portray Lukashenko as a mad retrograde, which means that perhaps it is not all that easy as he wants to present it.
But you mentioned to foreign media, you think they're reporting Belarus situation in quite an accurate way?
Well, like you said, Sergei, just let's see. Here is how the Wall Street Journal describes Lukashenko's latest instructions to Prime Minister Mikhail Mesnikovich and the head of the National Bank, Pyotr Prokopovich, whom we already mentioned. Look, if prices do not go lower, you, Mikhail Vladimirovich, and you, Pyotr Petrovich, can hand over your Communist Party tickets. Well, this is a description by the Wall Street Journal.
But this look okay? What's wrong
with
this?
In fact, that's what translators call a distortion. Because I wish we could say...
Distortion in what way? What do you mean?
Look, obviously, I was rather surprised to see that. He mentioning communist. He could be anything, but he's not a nut. And naturally enough, I looked it up for the Russian version of Lukashenko's speech, and actually it appeared...
I wish
we could say that the respected paper used an accurate translation, but let's say it was rather exaggerated, because in Russian it looked...
How did it sound in Russian? Tell me.
I'll better tell you. That's what he said. He said, if you insist, obviously, if you are accurate in your estimation that the dollar is worth 5,000 rubles and that introducing that rate would deal away with the speculative demand, then go ahead, he told his guys. But every day there must be some dynamic. If the dynamic is not there, Mikhail Vladimirovich and Pyotr Petrovich, then you'll be the first to hand in your party cards to use the Soviet wording. And It is a trifle. Well, the difference is minuscule, but still wonder if that is their usual way of presenting what's going on in Belarus in general.
Was there a secret word, part bilet, which means...
Yes, that's a party card.
Oh, my God.
But it is not a communist party card. We can, by the way, he used the expression to use the Soviet wording, which means that he has not fallen out of times. He's not a nut, but it is just a language to which he is accustomed.
Wow, but when once he mentioned part bilet, this is everything. It might sound a bit funny, but back in the USSR, a person without part bilet, especially someone ostracized from the party, was a socially handicapped person. And he had no chance to get a dignified position in society.
Well, we know Sakharov, by the way. He was never a member of the party.
Well, yes, of course, he was a different cup of tea altogether. But if you simply lost your party ticket or party card by negligence, I mean, anything could happen. It was, I mean, you were finished.
I can say some personal story, family story, you know. My father-in-law once misplaced the wretched thing, and it turned into a big personal drama for him. And it nearly undercut his diplomatic career.
But did he find it eventually? In the
He found it after some time, you know, but...
It cost him nerve. It cost him a lot of headache. But anyway, getting back to the subject...
That was a detective story, you know.
Was it you who found it?
Not really, but if you're interested, very briefly, I'm telling you. They implied hypnotizer, you know.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And he found it?
Yeah.
No.
Okay. With his help, you know.
That's a good one. Getting back to the subject, what Lukashenko's phrase really reveals to me is that 20 years after the collapse of the Soviet Union, he still retains Soviet thinking. Is my impression correct? Do you agree with that?
Yes, with this I agree, but just as a follow-up to what you say, I think that the present crisis shows that the existing model with inefficient state-run economy and authoritarian leadership in Belarus has already exhausted or almost exhausted its potential. And it is known that Belarus has lost half of its population in the Second World War.
Yeah. But they fought to the end.
Everywhere in the world, people value stability, but Belarusians, they doubly value the stability. And till recently, for them, Lukashenko was the embodiment of this stability. He was a person who was a guarantor of this stability. So it seems that this is no more. This is not the case.
Sergei, may I tell you something? Well, I have my own contacts with Belarusia, and let me tell you that the new generation does not have this feeling that Lukashenko and stability are this one and the same thing. Secondly, they are perhaps caring less for stability than for their perspectives. If I may say so, the Facebook generation, they want some perspective. Lukashenko doesn't promise it. Here's the
change. And the Belarus stability is changing also. In fact, it is not changing, it is degenerating. First,
it slipped
into stagnation
with
an uncrowned monarch at helm, and then into the present social tension and economic havoc.
And there's one more thing to it, I'd say. As he was building up his economic model, which obviously, according to some Soviet model, Mr. Lukashenko was also regarding Moscow as a source of cheap loans and gas, the so-called friendly prices, which actually kept Belarus' economy afloat for quite a while.
Yes. Well, let me cite a Belarusian journalist, Svetlana Kalinkina, of Narodnaya Vola newspaper, who writes, and I think it's very relevant, I would like to see those Russian romantics in the Kremlin who paid good money for sugary speeches, presenting them as a well-planned and long-term doctrine of foreign relations. I don't believe that all of them in the Kremlin were romantics. But anyway, that describes the process.
Mira, but when we speak about Kremlin, I think we have to understand that Kremlin finally made itself clear that friendship is friendship, but there would be no more free lunches. And Moscow said it bluntly that enough is enough. And I believe this is what really infuriated Lukashenko. This is not surprising at all, because today Lukashenko behaves just like a frustrated leader of a state subsisting on foreign donations who rebels against the donor country. When the donor says he's tired of being milked, this is the problem and this is the drama of Lukashenko. How I see it.
Well, I won't argue, of course it is so, but is this the way a neighbor, not to say a strategic partner, should behave?
Well, neighbors do quarrel, but sometimes even small differences growing into bitter quarrels. But these are all emotions. But let's look at what we've got now. A neighboring country seems to be sliding into deep economic crisis. Do you agree with that?
Of course.
Of course.
So, that, as it often happens, might bring on social instability.
It does.
You agree with that?
It's already there.
But not as much as it can. But which, in its turn, actually lowers expectations of reforms. Do you agree with that?
Of course.
No one argues.
No.
Okay.
No.
So, what needs to be done to prevent this scenario? And we discussed this issue with Cyril Koktish, expert in Belarus economy and assistant professor at the Moscow State Institute of Foreign Affairs.
Mr. Koktish, thank you very much for joining us. I suggest we could start from the start. What would you name as the key causes of the present crisis in Belarus?
The main problem is the lack of trust of the Belarusian society. The problem is that the current situation shouldn't have occurred. Belarus lost only $1 billion in bargaining with Russia. This is 1/15 of the Russian budget, so problems should be minor, but not so large scale. So what has happened? That the Belarusian inhabitants started to buy currency immediately after the presidential election, thus voting against the Belarusian power. Currently, the currency deficit is estimated up to $7 billion. So now we can estimate how much the lack of trust into the Russian economy and the Russian power, how large it is. This is the problem.
Did they have any reason to mistrust the economy?
There are too much of the reasons. First of all, it's a lack of the good relations with the neighbors. The Russian economy is export-oriented economy, and this is the rule that export-oriented economy should maintain good relations with the neighbors, because good relations means good trade. But now relations are almost ruined with Russia, and they're ruined with the West. So this is the reason number one. The second reason is the populist policy of the government, because the salaries were raised at least 1.5 before the elections, from an average $300 to $500. And this was done because of the debts, because of the foreign credit. This is the second reason. And the third reason is that the Russian economy, with the start of the global economic crisis, lost it at least half of its market. And this loss wasn't compensated so far. So for 2 years already, the Russian economy is supported with the credits, which are used only to support, maintain the status quo, but not to restructure the Russian economy to find the outcome of the current problems, because the level of life is being supported, because the problem is that the current level of life is not correlated with the Russian incomes. Russian debt now is estimated up to 60-70% of the Belarusian gross national product. So it's quite high level, not the highest.
Yeah, it's considerable.
Considerable,
it's considerable, true. But who are the debtors? Who are the international lending bodies lending credits to Belarus now?
There are two main lenders. First lender is Russia. And Russia so far has been supporting Belarus for $4-5 billion per year. And by the way, this is the next problem is forthcoming. Because in September this year, Russia will finish up constructing all the BTS-2, the oil pipeline, which will put oil around Belarus. So that means that $5 billion grant, which Belarus annually gets from Russia, will appear under the question, starting from the next year. So problem are expected to come on the next level, but not to be resolved. And second lender is the foreign funds, first of all, the National Monetary Fund, and substantial money were lended for the last 2-3 years, while there were hopes that the Russian regime will be a more democratic one. So it was claimed move to the democratization, and it was the flag of the European policy. But this policy collapsed in the end of the December last year. So this is the problem and this is the question, whether the West will continue to be the lender of the Belarusian economy.
So what are the conditions under which the IMF has already granted money to Belarus?
There were standard conditions, or we can tell that it was almost no conditions at all, because the credit of the IMF were given to support the Russian economy and to support the European policy of the democratization of Belarus. So that means that there were political hopes and that was lack of the economic demands. And I'm not sure that this situation will continue this year because quite a lot has changed. Belarus has political prisoners now and West is declared that policy has collapsed. And Russia also is not happy to be the main supporter of the Belarusian regime, which starts to be odious.
So are the Belarusian authorities trying to reform, so restructure their national economy in a way? Do you see any indications of that?
No, this is a problem. But you see, another side of the problem, there is no simple decisions. 80% of the Russian income is being brought by four enterprises. There's two refineries, Belaruskali, which exports the...
Potassium.
Yes, the Belaruskali, which exports potassium, And the 20% comes to the Russian automobile industry, truck industry, and whatever else. You see, there are a lot of the enterprises which could be privatized quite effectively because most of the Russian economy tend to be ineffective with the beginning of the crisis in 2008. So this is a problem that the enterprise, which is not effective currently under the state management, it sure would be even more effective with the private management. So civil privatization now will not be a decision. So, of course, IMF and Russia will demand privatization, but this is, can help for a short period of time. And the matter is that the whole structure of the Russian economy should be changed. If Belarus wants to keep the 80% of income to be gained due to the foreign trade, so it should find what can be sold, with what good it, Belarus can, but can be present in European market and in Russian market. But this is the process that should be started. There are discussions that this should be done for the last 3 years, but no indications that power and authorities are ready to move on this way. Actually, it's a very hard way, because up to now, the Belarusian authorities were exploiting the Soviet resource, but not introducing anything new.
What would you suggest? Do you think that perhaps there is a way to combine social-oriented principles of the national economy the way, as far as I understand, Mr. Lukashenko is looking at, and more efficient economic models in such a small country like Belarus?
Well, you see, social standards actually are not the problem, because the Russian social standard is free medicine and free education. But you see, this medicine and the medical care and education is always paid. Are paid either to the taxes, either with the private users. So if these goods are being paid through taxes, they tend to be cheaper for the national economy, even cheaper. So social standards are not a burden to the Belarusian economy. The burden is that the Belarus can't get enough income and can't propose enough goods to the foreign market. So this is a problem that, for example, Belarus has accessible quantity of the qualified working power, for example, which can be combined with the Russian inventions and with the best Western industry quality of industry production. So these things can be combined, but first of all, the trust should be built to enable these things to be combined.
But do you think that perhaps Mr. Lukashenko could use some guarantees to foreign investors and that would attract foreign investors to Belarus? Do you think that could be a way out?
I am not saying that this will be an argument. You see, money will always come to the country when there is a smell of the income, the smell of high income. It doesn't matter whether it's a democratic regime, whether it's a dictator. So that the matter is that you are not able to get any income in this country. And this is the main problem. Of course, Lukashenko can issue guarantee. I'm not sure that his guarantees will be trusted anymore. Well, this is my private opinion, because putting myself on the place of the investor, I would doubt investing in the country where with the unstable currency system, because you never know whether you will gain, whether you will lose. But actually, this is a matter number two. And matter number one, that there is no, currently there is no possibility to make money in the Russian economy, at least to make simple money in the Russian economy, where the money can come, can get the income, and then can compensate the risk, because high income is a very good stimulator to compensate, and high income is a guarantee that any risk can be afforded.
But, Mr. Koktesh, if we compare the two economic models, I mean, the Belarusian model and the Chinese model, because as far as we know, China is still a communist country and it is number one by FDI amount. Is that correct? So what attracts investors to China and how come that they aren't attracted to that communist country and they mistrust Belarus, which is smaller and perhaps which is a little bit easier to understand?
Well, it's very simple comparison. You see, the Chinese economy, it has very cheap working power. It's low qualified, mostly low qualified, but it's extremely cheap. And as long as it continues to be extremely cheap, China will be attractive to the foreign capital, to the foreign investment. The Russian economy, the Russian working power can't be cheap as compared to the Chinese, because in one case you can pay an average of $40, $50 as a monthly salary, even less, and get more or less competitive product. And in the Russian case you have to pay at least $300 as a monthly salary. So this is the problem number one. The problem number two is that China has specialization, good trade routes, and the history of the crust, which Belarus can't provide to the investors. But you see, the reason number one is quite enough. China is a cheap working power, beating all the economies in the world, because nobody can produce the goods with so cheap working power. And as long as it continues, China will be out of competition.
So what would you suggest the Belarusian authorities should do?
Well, they should find another product. They should find another economy. There should be innovations. For example, the Russian economy can work as a technopark to test the inventions that, for example, Russia has plenty of them. Russia has, but has no resources and no desire of the authorities even to test them, because Russia prefers to keep fast in to the oil economy. It's quite enough to provide authorities consider that it's quite enough to provide economic growth. So many of the inventions continue to be put aside of the mainstream, but the Russian economy and the Russian interest can be good magnet, for example, to collect these inventions and, for example, to provide the way from an adventure to the prototype of the product. The first way, which that could be very simple. Well, it's not simple, but it's quite obvious what can be done. Other combinations can be found as well. But first of all, to make such restructuring, you should sit down on the table with your neighbors and decide what your neighbors are ready to buy from you. What can be combined? How the win-win game can be built with your neighbors. The school is almost absent currently in Belarus, but unfortunately it's almost absent in Europe and in Russia. But after all, the good reason to return to this school, because this is the sum plus game, when win I, when win you. So this can be started. I'm not sure the Belarusian authorities will be ready to start such a game and even to think in terms of this game. But this is a solution to Belarus. I am not sure that these authorities will be able to use this solution.
Well, Mr. Koktish, thank you very much.
You're tuned to the Voice of Russia.
And now we're moving to our next section, Between the Lines, in which we usually look at one of the most interesting publications on one of the past week's most pressing political issues. And this time, it's going to be a story run by the Time magazine on Wednesday under the title of What Mediating in Libya Could Cost Medvedev, written by Simon Schuster. So if you ask me, it really looks like a major challenge both for Russia and, just let me stress it, the whole of the international community.
Well, that's right, Katya, but still, to me, it's quite significant that after all this time, the international community has ultimately turned to Russia to help work out the peaceful solution.
Well, Sergei, I think there is a good explanation to that. Just let me remind you of what Mr. Margelov, who is Russia's president, special envoy to the Middle East and Africa, said on the issue. Russia is in a unique position to negotiate, he said, because Russian soldiers have never fought against the African countries or against the African people. And besides, we have preserved our embassy in Tripoli, which is important, no doubt, and have preserved contacts with the people in Gaddafi's surrounding. At the same time, Russia is developing contacts with the Libyan rebels.
Mira,
which
but,
is the
but
right
I
position.
Have seen all sort of speculations in foreign media claiming that it was not the international community, but Russia which suggested it might take on mediator's role.
Well, I've seen that, and I'm not surprised. However, Mr. Lavrov said it plain and clear in his recent interview to the Bloomberg agency that President Obama and President Sarkozy and, like he put it, other partners requested Russia's help on the issue.
So this was their initiative?
It was their initiative, plain and clear. And by the way, the Times story is describing in a similar fashion. Just let me quote, with the war at a stalemate and the West apparently out of options for negotiating a truce, the U.S. asked Russia last week to step in and try to convince Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi to make a deal.
Look, I can see no logic in that. From the onset, Russia was not supported. Russia has not supported the West intervention in Libya. You might also remember that Vladimir Putin described it as a crusade at one time. Is there any good reason why Russia should meddle in now?
Okay, but let's make it clear. It's quite obvious that our Western partners now are not capable of resolving the crisis on their own. Do you agree with that?
Yes, of course. NATO-led operation is losing its steam, obviously. And it seems that Gaddafi turned out to be a tough nut.
Yes.
So somebody has to get inside, whether you call it mediator's role or someone who is
actually,
just negotiating.
There's a huge crowd trying to negotiate.
In brief, something has to be done. It can't go on forever. This is
so
clear.
Russia has agreed to help. We've kind of agreed to help sort out the mess created by someone else. And the position, okay, it is noble. Is it pragmatic? I'd say it's a gamble. And it's certainly a gamble for Mr. Medvedev. And now, just how it goes and how much time it takes, no one can tell.
Of course, no one can tell how long it would take. Well, you haven't answered my question, Katya, though, of course. We need time to see how it works out.
Well, Tripoli certainly needs time, but it's running out. Though, by the way, NATO has extended its mandate till September.
And I don't think that this news is exactly encouraging for the Libyan leadership. But I also doubt whether it could serve to boost their decision-making on how to resolve the crisis.
Definitely this news has to force them to enter into negotiating process.
But they've been forced for quite a while already. They've been forced and it didn't work, which obviously means, like Mr. Lavrov said, we should turn creative. We should become creative in that. So the 2 months have not appeared to be exactly efficient in driving Gaddafi out. Is that correct?
You know, Katya, NATO command said they made the decision after Mr. Gaddafi said he was not going to step down.
And here's what could be described as a vicious circle then. But I'm not sure that this philosophy suits well with the relatives of the roughly 800 civilians who have been killed after the start of the NATO operation. And that's a real shame both for all parties to the conflict. So no one has protected them in the long run despite all the UN sanctions, all the UN Security Council resolutions. So nor the international community, nor their own government, nor the so much caring opposition.
Katya, that's another proof that time is running out. But let me tell you, Katya, I think you failed to mention something really important.
What is it?
While most of the international community was rather puzzled about Russia's stance on Libyan issue, Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov stated loud and clear that Gaddafi regime must give up power.
Oh, that. Yes, you're right, Sergei.
Let me quote. Colonel Gaddafi has deprived himself of legitimacy with his action. This is what Ryabkov told reporters in Deauville. And he added that we should help him leave.
Okay.
Well, still a tiny question remains. Who and how could convince Gaddafi to do it?
Look, like we like to say, it takes two to dance a tango, right?
Exactly.
So the opposition has been rather unhelpful in the international effort to convince him to leave. Because on Tuesday, South African President Jacob Zuma left Gaddafi and then told the press that the Libyan leader had stated he would not leave Libya. Okay, he did not say that he's not going to step down, but he said that he would not leave Libya. However, as we know, the opposition, or whatever has been called as the opposition, has been rather unbendable, demanding that he and his family and his friends and his allies and his relatives must leave the country. So that's a dead end, right?
So then we are coming to the question of mediator. The situation needs a mediator. And that's what you are driving at, Katya?
The impartial mediator?
Partial mediator.
Yes, but let's resort to our usual ultimate solution, because obviously we've discussed it all. But now let's turn to our expert. And this time it's Dr. Vladimir Akhmedov, one of the leading Russian experts in the Middle East and North Africa security issues.
Yes, I think we need a pundit like this.
Dr. Akhmedov, there are some very different views on Russia's emerging role in the resolution of the Libyan crisis. But how effective could Russia's participation in this process be, both for Russia and for the global community?
The fact that the global community, first and foremost the coalition countries involved in the operation in Libya, has approached Russia for help indicates that the West has reconsidered a military resolution to the Libyan crisis. Recall that a number of Western countries quite simply ignored Russia's initial proposal and draft UN Security Council, which was tabled at the outset of the operation and had some very positive ideas and proposals. Undeniably, the coalition has sufficient potential to crush Gaddafi, deliver a decisive blow, and destroy all of the colonel's armed forces. But this is fraught with a great number of victims and will create a very unpleasant precedent for the West and its politics. This is especially relevant for the politics of the United States, because whichever way you look at it, they are at the forefront of these efforts, notwithstanding their attempts to shift the focus to NATO. it will also impact on their image in the new Middle East. Bear in mind that at the G8 summit, the member countries articulated their positions on the revolutionary events unfolding in the Arab East. They are allocating funds and striving to bring these processes into a normal order of things, towards the establishment of new political models of government in the Middle East. And this does not accord with the application of force. So, their approaching us and returning to our initial ideas points to the fact that the Russian proposals were very sensible and sound. Another issue is how well we are able to advocate our position and get it across, to the extent which we are able to insist upon our suggestions and convince our Western partners that we are right. Anyway, in the end, objective reality has ended up pushing them towards accepting these proposals. The fact that the West has asked Russia to help achieve a political accommodation and establish a political dialogue between the belligerent parties is the ultimate testament to that.
But so do I understand correctly that the major difficulty of such talks come from a very tough stance of the anti-government forces? I deliberately don't say opposition because there isn't really a united front in the anti-government camp and there is no real clarity as to who to talk to there. Is that fair or are there other complicating factors?
Russia's mission is by no means simple, because, as I said, not everyone is ready to lay down arms and stop fighting the colonel, including in the opposition. And there are similarly inclined forces in the opposite camp who continue to hope that they will have enough capacity to crush the revolutionary oppositionists from Benghazi. So there is a great difficulty there. Some really fine and pinpoint work in finding key figures on both sides who command sufficient authority and respect with the people and who are ready to sit down and talk. But it is a noble cause, and it's in the interests of our country, because we can't allow ourselves to completely abstain from the resolution of the Libyan crisis if we want to remain in the region.
But as far as I recall, South African President Jacob Zuma went to Libya on several occasions and met with Gaddafi, and Gaddafi said that he would be ready to step down if he was provided with certain guarantees for him and his family. Yet Benghazi responded with a very firm no. So the rebels are not at all considering an option that would allow Gaddafi to hand over power, but save face nonetheless. So, but why is that?
My understanding is that there are diverse positions and these positions are changing. If you think back to the beginning of the conflict, before the military operation began, there were proposals from Hugo Chavez on resolving the conflict through peaceful diplomatic means by offering certain guarantees to Gaddafi. But this was practically ignored by the Arab community and by the West, as well as in Libya itself. Although I got the impression that Gaddafi was ready to discuss such options, I agree with you that at this stage the revolutionaries, encouraged by the examples of Egypt and Tunisia, expect the events to develop rather quickly, and they underestimated the power of the colonel. That position is changing now, and Gaddafi stepping down with certain guarantees might suit a large part of the opposition.
Well, Dr. Akhmedov, thank you very much.
This is the Voice of Russia.
And now we're moving to the Red Line's third section, The Man and the News. This week, it is Ratko Mladic, one of the key figures in the post-communist Balkan history, 67-year-old former commander of Serbian armed forces. General Mladic was arrested last week after 16 years of hiding in a village north of Belgrade to be extradited to the Hague Tribunal. International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia at the Hague has indicted Mladic on an impressive list of charges, including a whole range of war crimes like the 1992 campaign of ethnic cleansing in eastern Bosnia, establishment of concentration camps in the northwest Bosnia, 3-year siege of Sarajevo, taking of the UN hostages in 1995 during NATO airstrikes, and the 1995 Srebrenica massacre of several thousand Muslim men and boys. So briefly, this is his story. And today, he's been presented to the tribunal in The Hague.
Well, but the story had a long echo in Serbia, and the news of Ratko Mladic's arrest and the Serbian government decision to extradite him immediately hit the world headlines, and it virtually split Serbia. And while held by a section of Serbs who call Mladic butcher of Srebrenica, it is violently opposed by the radical Serb nationals, demanding resignation of President Boris Tadic and his government.
Obviously for handing Mladic to the international tribunals. That's right.
You know, their slogan is Tadic is not Serbia.
Tadic is not Serbia. But yes, of course, because Belgrade saw massive demonstrations these days. It was reported that 1,000-strong police force was brought in to contain the huge crowd of protesters who threw rocks, bottles and sticks at policemen. And it was also reported that dozens of demonstrators were injured, while 100 protesters were detained. And it is believed that 10,000 demonstrators gathered in Belgrade protests all in all. Well, which is a figure?
Well, they say that Lazareva, the village where Mladic was found and arrested, is nicknamed now as Serbian Abbottabad after Obama bin Laden's hideout in Pakistan, because it became world famous, Abbottabad, so it was applied to Lazareva also. In fact, it is equally hard to believe that Mladic was able to hide for 16 years as bin Laden was hiding for God knows how many years in Pakistan without some kind of a covert protection or at least laissez-faire from the authorities.
Well, is it sheer coincidence that Mladic gets arrested, surrenders without resistance, right in time when Serbia is pushing so hard to the EU membership?
Katya, I personally believe that Serbia's European Union membership, this issue could have played a role, and President Tadic's opponents, in fact, accused him of taking a deal with Brussels, of which his quick decision to extradite Mladic is a part. And meanwhile, Ratko Mladic is denying his responsibility for 1995 massacre in Srebrenica, which is regarded, as you know, by the Europeans as the worst atrocity Europe has witnessed since the Holocaust.
Yes. Then the French Liberation praises the intransigence of Brussels vis-à-vis Belgrade, insisting that there would be no discussions on accession without Serbian cooperation with the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. And let me quote, "It was this intransigence in the upholding of our values that has paid off, together with the attraction the Union exerts and the impatience of the Serbs to join the envied circle of member states one day."
Well, I think we can agree that the details of the story of Mladic's arrest is still confusing. Was it an arrest or a surrender, after all? I still can't sort it out.
We have first-hand information from a well-known Serbian journalist, Boris Kolkodelovic.
Around at 5 o'clock, that's quite early. It is a bit a village, according to Russian standards, about 3,000 inhabitants, small place called Lazarevo, 80 kilometers northeast from Belgrade, near the border with Romania, and the largest city in area is called Zrenjanin. Formerly it was called Petrograd because a lot of Russian emigres after the First World War and the revolution settled there. So in Lazarevo, at least three police cars and several luxury cars have arrived, and it seems that there was a search of 3 to 4 houses in a village. All belonged to people with the surname Mladic. A village is inhabited with people, we have called them after Second World War colonizers, people who have settled from Bosnia, Dalmatia, and poorer regions, Montenegro, poorer regions of former Yugoslavia to the very fertile land of Vojvodina. So today, descendants of those colonizers, settlers, and three houses belong to the Mladic, extended Mladic family. In one of the houses was, it seems, person who is identified now as Mr. Ratko Mladic, and without any resistance, he surrendered himself to police. He was later on brought to the headquarters of our security services in Belgrade.
Well, according to some reports in Western media, Mladic's arrest was an entirely stage-managed event, and there's a belief that it was the result not of a police actual work, but of negotiations by diplomats who spent a whole year hammering out a deal to get him to surrender. A Western diplomat disclosed the negotiations about Mladic's surrender lasted slightly more than a year. It appears that Mladic finally made up his mind to surrender after he got assurance that all his family would be looked after properly if he gave himself up.
Well, some story, I must say. Anyway, the former general and an icon is now facing the tribunal in The Hague, and meanwhile, his son has been insisting that his father was a freedom fighter who defended his own nation, defended his people in an honorable, fair and professional manner. And masses of people support that view, and they are suspicious about the Hague justice, no?
That's right, and Serbs are known for their distrust of International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, which they accuse of being biased. They say that just the purpose of the tribunal is just to make Serbs major perpetrators of war crimes, so they don't believe in this. And, you know, it is not that I share this view, but I don't think that all is well with these hands of justice without borders.
Well, at one point it really looked like an idea of international trials for those who committed crimes against the humanity all over the post-world, but be it Balkans, Africa or Asia. No, I agree with you, Sergei, it has somehow lost its steam. And have you heard about any Muslim leader brought to the Hague or criminal?
Not a single
similar
Muslim
crimes
leader.
In the Bosnian War. But wars are always a scene of crimes against humanity, if you agree with me, which means that both parties commit those crimes. So it would have been only fair if we have seen some...
This is the question, how you interpret the results of
that's
the war.
Right. But it seems that as things stand now, the justice without borders, you could, as you put it, is at the crossroads.
But
you know?
Can you spell it out? What do you mean?
Well, the good example is Colonel Gaddafi, whom we've been discussing earlier. Still, there is no full understanding whether he should ultimately face the trial or whether he should be allowed to leave if he agrees to lay down arms. I mean, the standing of this court is really vague.
Katya, but Gaddafi is a separate story and we already discussed it today, so let us come back to Balkans. I think the idea of justice without border you are referring to has become increasingly popular after the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia was established in 1993. That was sort of a kickstart of the process, you know?
Okay.
That was the first international court to deal with crimes against humanity, to deal with...
War crimes
after the Second World
War. The international community was
after
quite
Nuremberg.
Enthusiastic
That's right. And it took only 1 year to set a similar court for Rwanda, so the process started.
Yes.
And this is
important. But then suddenly it died out. I remember there was a lot of discussions and drum beating and euphoria at the time, and experts were predicting that the era of lawlessness was finally paving the way for a new era where law and justice would triumph. Yes, I remember that.
But this is understandable. The expectations were high because, let me just quote UN statistics, the post-war world witnessed 250 military conflicts.
250?
Yes, which claimed, can you imagine, 86 million lives.
Awful.
And add on to that more than 170 million wounded turned into refugees or subjected to violence and human rights abuses. And however, it's maybe this is a paradox, the biggest paradox, but very few statesmen and military commanders who have resorted to war as a quick mechanism to solve their problems have ever been more accountable. And this is why this mechanism of justice without border was set in motion.
Okay.
But don't you think, Sergei, that the performance of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia revealed the limitations of justice without borders?
Mira, both yes and no.
But let me tell you how I see it. So, as it turned out with the International Criminal Tribunal for former Yugoslavia, so the questions of crime and punishment had become a subject of, so to say, behind-the-scene wheeling and dealing with the worst spirit of real politics. And it is quite unfortunately that the court essentially has turned into a political instrument of some of the Western community, with universal legal principles applied highly selectively, grossly, and of course that undermines the court's credibility. And Ratko Mladic's case can well become a textbook example.
Well, I think that the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia Ratko Mladic case would be another acid test.
Well, and now let's listen to Borislav Korkodelovic coming to us all the way from Serbia. What is Ratko Mladic accused of?
Ratko Mladic, a former commander of the army of Bosnian Serbs, he had a rank of four-star general, lieutenant colonel, as we call him. He has been accused twice by tribunal in Hague, mainly for the war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. The genocide is linked to the massacre. There are various figures, but they are ranking from 8,000 of Muslim or Bosniak men and youngsters. So that is an official charge.
And what are the various versions around that? Because as far as I know, the whole story has been disputed by different sides. So what is the truth?
I think the real truth will be known during the trial of Mr. Mladic, because it seems definitely there were massacres of some of the captured members of the Bosniak Muslim army, but also some of them have been killed while resistance, some of them killed while they were trying to run away, some of them killed while Serbs were defending themselves. So still, as you rightly said, there are various versions, and maybe the right one, even there were stories of complicity of some foreign intelligence services, particularly French, because Mr. Mladic was dealing with some of the French generals, commanders of Srebrenica, which was designated as a safe zone by the United Nations. But from that safe zone, during 2 or 3 years of the war, Muslim units used to attack the nearby Serbian villages, and they have committed their crimes too. And their commander, the commander of those Muslim units, Nasser Oric, was tried several years ago in Hague, but he was released because there was, according to judges, no enough concrete proofs that he committed crimes against Serbs. So it is rather disputed story, a very emotional one, which is touching both Muslims in Bosnia, Muslims in Serbia, but also a lot of Serbs. So maybe the best thing will be to wait and see what will be the truth according to Mr. Mladic.
But Mr. Krkodilovic, if we remember the case of President Milosevic, do you think that Mr. Mladic has a chance to be heard and to be treated differently at the ICC in Hague?
No, I think more or less it will be the same pattern. But, you know, Mr. Milosevic died before he could hear the sentence about his policies. But even before he died, there was no common denominator about his defense. Some people were saying that he was rather successful in defending himself. You remember that he had no lawyer, that he refused to have any lawyer. So I think maybe it is not very satisfying response, but history will say more about his defense. Definitely, it is, in a way, for a legal history, important that there is no sentence in Milosevic case. So with Mladic, maybe he will survive up to the end of his trial, and maybe he will be able to say all what he knows. Never mind that we understand that he is in a rather poor health, that he had some severe problems with his veins and high blood pressure. So he is not pretty well.
Which means that he would anyway need medical assistance while he's in jail.
I think so.
Let's hope it will be granted.
I think it will be granted. It can't be refused. But, you know, after Milosevic's fate, there must be suspicion.
Mr. Krkodilovic, thank you very much.
Well, and with this we end this edition of Redline, brought to you by the Voice of Russia radio station. It was presented by its founders, Sergei Strokin and Mira Salganik, and myself, Ekaterina Kudashkina. Thank you very much for staying with us. Goodbye.
Take care and goodbye.
Take care
and goodbye.
Take care
and goodbye.
Take care
and goodbye.
Take care
and goodbye.
Take care
and goodbye.
Take care.